We're just allowing our bodies to arrive and feeling our weight held by the earth. Breathing in and breathing out. And just being here fully in this moment, just the way it is, with whatever is arising in our body, in our mind. And as we listen to three sounds of the bell, we can just allow ourselves to be and just let go of whatever we're carrying, whatever thoughts or knots that we might be entangled with in our mind, and just let it all go. Just for three sounds of the bell. You can pick it back up again if you like after the bell. So dear Pai, dear Sangha, I'm just really struck of how much of a difference it makes for me that only one ear is open. This is my first time experiencing this. I feel like I have half of me turned inward. And I'm hearing my voice from inside as well as through this ear from outside. And so I also invite us, as we listen this morning, to turn part of our energy inward, part of our attention inward, even as we are focused outward to receive and to hear, but that we stay present to our own body and to our own needs as we listen. So I want to begin by telling a story. I came across this book, Gaviotas. It's a Spanish for seagull. It's a story of a community in Colombia that strange to live in a very uninhabitable place in the eastern plains of Colombia, with tremendous ingenuity and innovation, using appropriate technology that was also very adaptable to developing countries. And I'll just tell you a little bit about them from the jacket cover. So they've been there since the 60s. They're still there, so that's over 40 years. So for nearly three decades, scientists, artisans, rural peasants, ex-urban street kids have developed this village. It's 16 hours from the nearest major city. And there they've invented windmills light enough to convert mild tropical breezes into energy. Solar collectors that work in the rain. Soil-free systems, because there's aluminum in the soil there, so they can't grow anything. Soil-free systems to raise edible and medicinal crops. Solar kettles to sterilize drinking water. And ultra-efficient pumps to tap deep aquifers. Pumps so easy to operate that they're hooked up to children's seesaws. At the school. They've built a school, they have a hospital that treats people from all around. The hospital runs on solar, and they have cattle. They collect the dung and funnel it down and use the methane from the dung of the cattle to run the stoves in the hospital. It's incredible. So the United Nations named the village a model for the developing world. And they've made this technology available all over Colombia. So in Bogota and Medellin, when they build 1,000-unit public housing, they all have solar water heaters developed and designed by people in Gaviotas who have trained street kids in Bogota to become the technicians to make them. Anyway, it's a fascinating story. So this is a story told by the former president of Colombia, who was a big friend of this community when he was a senator. So there was a group, I think it's from the Inter-American Development Bank. This is a bank set up by the World Bank to help bring development into South America, Latin America. So the president of this bank was a Chilean economist, and he told of a tiny Indian village on the high Altiplano near Bolivia's Lake Titicaca, where he'd gone on a feasibility study for a proposed hydroelectric dam. When they completed the site visit, his team realized they hadn't used their entire travel budget. Since the village lacked everything, they assembled the local chiefs and explained that they had some money left. In gratitude for hospitality and assistance, they wanted to give it to the community as a gift. "What project would you like us to fund here in the name of the bank?" The Indian elders excused themselves and went off to discuss this offer. In just 5 minutes, they returned. "We know what we want to do with the money." "Excellent, whatever you want." "We need new musical instruments for our band." "Maybe," replied the bank team spokesman, "you didn't understand. What you need are improvements like electricity, running water, sewers, telephone, and telegraph." But the Indians had understood perfectly. "In our village," the eldest explained, Everyone plays a musical instrument. On Sundays after Mass, we all gather for La Retreta, a concert in the church patio. First, we make music together. After that, we can talk about our problems in the community and how to resolve them. But our instruments are old and falling apart. Without music, so will we. And so I share this story because there's a lot of wisdom in how we look at our suffering. Sometimes we want to go at it directly, to tackle it. And sometimes just by watering the positive seeds in us, by coming into harmony first in a more indirect way, is what allows the suffering in us also to be held, to have a foundation where it can then be, it has a lap to rest on. So I want to share today about the four right efforts. This is in the Eightfold Path. It's one of the aspects of the path is diligence or effort. And so there are four ways that the Buddha talked about practicing correctly, basically. Because we can have wrong or unskillful effort in our practice. So the four ways all have to do with how we water the seeds in our consciousness. Because we all have all kinds of seeds. In Buddhist psychology, we talk about 51 kinds of mental formations, or kinds of energies that can be activated in us. And we all have all 51. So we all have the seeds of anger, the seeds of mindfulness, the seeds of peace, the seeds of forgiveness, the seeds of jealousy, the seeds of despair, of violence. And how we manifest our life has to do with which seeds we water. Like a garden, you know. Our consciousness is like a garden holding all of these seeds, and the practice is to be a skilled gardener and water the seeds that will bring about happiness, well-being, connection, to avoid watering the seeds that will bring about suffering and division, despair. So the first element of right diligence is to water the positive seeds. So if they're not manifesting, do something to make them manifest. And Tai, I'm hearing him say this more and more in the last years. We can always do something to help the positive seeds in us manifest. At any moment, that's what it means to be a practitioner, is to really become skilled at this art of creating happiness, of creating well-being, peace, understanding for ourselves. So I'm going to go through a number of ways we can do this. So we all experience feelings. It's one of the five skandhas, the five aggregates that make up each human process. These are all a process. We call them like five streams, these five skandhas. One is our form, our body. One is our feelings. One is our perceptions. One is our mental formations, these 51 kinds of seeds in our store consciousness. And the last is our consciousness. So when we talk about feelings, there are different kinds of feelings. So there's pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, neutral feelings, and mixed feelings. And it's both pleasant and unpleasant. Like a good massage that's kind of painful, releasing tension. A little bit unpleasant, but also pleasant. So it is said, and I think maybe we can each see for ourselves if it's accurate for us, that most of our feelings are neutral. That a lot of our life is neither particularly pleasant nor particularly unpleasant. So one way to practice to bring up the positive seeds is to be aware of when we're having a neutral feeling. We're quite aware when we have a pleasant feeling, when we have an unpleasant feeling, but often the neutral feeling goes undetected. So that means a lot of our life goes undetected. So like if you have both ears unblocked right now, that could change from a neutral feeling to a positive feeling. But I wouldn't have known that until so one ear got blocked. Like, what a nice experience that is to feel, you know, both ears open. But I'm sure we've all had moments where some aspect of our well-being was removed. You know, a stuffy nose or a backache or a knee pain or, you know, a hangnail. These are some very small things, but they can really be, physically at least, a source of suffering. And then when they go away, we're very relieved. But that doesn't last very long. Then we take it for granted that that's how it always is, that's normal. So the being aware of a neutral feeling is being aware of all the problems we don't have. It's one way to look at it. And we're appreciating that, right? Like, because the absence of ill being is well being. If we know how to appreciate it. And that can be, you know, a moment of gratitude, a moment of happiness, of contentment. It doesn't take, you know, getting a raise or a promotion or a new car. You know, there's lots of little happinesses we can really rejoice in if we know how to make use of the neutral feelings. Like, I like to, you know, be aware when I'm about to take off on a plane of how, you know, if everybody else on the plane hadn't decided to get that ticket, I couldn't have taken that flight. It just kind of, I'm connected to all these people. These people have kind of offered me something in a way. So just, you know, just shifting a little bit how we tend to look. So Tai once asked us to do an exercise. I was not yet a nun. I was living in Plum Village. And he said, for 1 week, please pay attention as much as you can to the time that you are in the toilet, that you're in the bathroom. And so I did this, and I found out a lot of things. I found out how much I rushed those activities of going to the toilet, taking a shower, how kind of violent my emotions were, because I felt I needed to hurry, but I didn't really need to hurry, but I was in the habit of somehow doing that with not much awareness. And so I decided to go slower and to do each action with as much awareness as I could. And then going to the bathroom was really amazing, to just like realize in all my years of life up until then how much of myself was out in the world in all different places, you know, how much had come through me, how much had passed, you know, out of me. And I kind of saw it all in one heap. A lifetime of fertilizer, I hope. But it was like, wow, like, so somehow it was a very fresh experience to use the bathroom. Like, this has been a part of me. Now it's no longer a part of me, my body, but it's going to be part of the earth in some other way. Just kind of touching, like, my connection with, you know, all the food, you know, all of the sewer systems that had taken care of my waste, you know, treatment facilities, and yeah, so that was a neutral experience that became, you know, a really fun discovery time. So there are lots of ways we can help the positive seeds in us to come up. One that I also really love is the practice of writing love letters. This is a practice Tai has encouraged us to do to help us reconcile also with people that we're estranged from, but with anybody. Even if we have a good relationship with them. So I decided to do this when my dad turned, I think it was 68. Yeah, I decided to write 68 thank yous. And at first I didn't know if I could write so many, but I just started and I found myself touching so many little gratitudes that I had never been aware of before, that I had never thought to thank him for. Like all the times he did my diapers and how he braided my hair and how he always made sure I brushed my teeth before I'd go to see the dentist. Or how he encouraged me to give away money every year. How he would say no when I needed a no growing up. How he would apologize if he felt he had been wrong. And one thing led to another, and it just felt like this snowball. And the more more things I was writing down, the more things I remembered. And it just, so many seeds of happiness came up in me, seeds of gratitude and love. And so I wrote, I think, almost 100. And of course, this watered many positive seeds in him when he received it. Because this practice of helping the good seeds to manifest, it's for us, but it's also for others. That's also part of right diligence, is to help the positive seeds sprout in people around us. So he told me that he takes that letter with him wherever he goes. And that when he doesn't feel so good about himself, he pulls it out and reads it, and it makes him feel a lot better. And I've shared this as a practice with many people, and many people have told me that it's been a very powerful thing in their lives. A sister in France did this for her father's 50th birthday. She wrote him 50 thank yous, and they'd had, I think, some difficulties in their relationship, and the father told his daughter, I've been waiting for this letter for my whole life. And I think he really meant for someone to see me so deeply, to see me that way. And friends have told me they've written a letter like that for their partner, that had a very big impact on their relationship. So yeah, whatever we water, it grows. We're all really very organic, this garden in us. It's very responsive to the gardener. So we have a lot of say over who we are. So our teacher also has said something I find very beautiful, that we need to live in such a way that we create a beautiful past. That we have memories to look back on that can really nourish us. And I was on a trip to South Africa and Botswana a few years ago with a sister and two brothers. And one of the brothers, was like a tea master. And so we would be at the airport meeting about the retreat schedule, and he would pull out a teapot and four glass teacups. This was loose leaf tea that he would rinse with the first rinse of boiled water that he brought in his thermos, pour that out, and he'd put more boiled water, and then he'd serve all of this tea. And I was, wow, that always impressed me. and it gave such a nice feeling of brotherhood and sisterhood to our meeting. But inside I would also be like, I would never do that, travel with breakable cups and a teapot and then this loose leaf tea. I mean, I was kind of like, I just, you know, wouldn't be able to do that. Then we were, you know, in Africa, we were at our host's home and, you know, had to meet again and plan this day of mindfulness. And again, he manifests fresh tea for everyone. And, you know, it's just this very refreshing thing. Each time I just saw how much it added to our being together. So at the end of our time, we had just finished our main retreat and we got to go on a little excursion to a nearby waterfall. And so we had to swim across a pond to get to the waterfall. And so this brother was, you know, carrying a bag on his head. And I was like, what's he doing? It's really difficult to swim with a bag on your head. Anyway, so we climb up the waterfall rocks and we're at the top of the waterfall and out comes a pot of tea and steaming tea for everybody. And you know, I always feel so happy just remembering that his determination to bring us that beautiful, simple pleasure. To make a list of all the things we can do to water the good seeds in us, to help them arise, and post it somewhere where we can see it every day, and we can try to do one thing on that list every day. It can be something simple, like petting the cat, petting the dog. Just quietly really enjoying a cup of tea and just drinking the tea. So yeah, this is you know, being aware of the conditions of happiness that already exist in the present moment. We don't have to wait for something else to make us happy. So that's the first part of right effort. The second part is that once the positive seeds have manifested, we want to keep them manifesting as long as possible. And this is the same for ourselves and other people as well. And a sister told me that she had heard a talk or read an article that said there are five things we can do every day that are keys to our happiness. And they are to do a random act of kindness every day, to meditate every day, to exercise every day, to journal a happy moment, and to be aware of three things that we're grateful for. And so this keeping the positive seeds manifesting, I see writing about them as a way to kind of increase them, increase their impact, and also just reflecting at the end of the day, what are we grateful for? Also, whatever has happened that was nourished us, we get nourished by it again when we write it down or reflect on our gratitude for that thing. And there was an article in the New York Times that also expressed how good this is for our health to be aware of our gratitude. That it has researchers have documented all the effects it has, like lowering blood pressure, lowering bad cholesterol levels, helping people sleep better. When you wake up, you feel more refreshed, improving immunity, and just reflecting on what we're grateful for. And in a study, they didn't even have people do it every day, but just once a week, to be aware of five things they were grateful for. And those who did that after 2 months just showed a very big difference in well-being than those who didn't. Yeah, I did this with my mom when I was a novice nun. I invited her to write down every day what she was grateful for a month, and I did the same, and we sent it to each other. So then we increased each other's happiness by reading what the other had been grateful for during that month. So, yeah, the past is available to us in the present. And so, for positive memories, bringing them up to be nourished is a way to sustain those positive mental formations. So the third practice is kind of the third and fourth are like mirror opposites of the first and second. So the third is to not allow seeds of suffering to be watered. And the first two aspects of right diligence, if we do these regularly, bringing up the positive, keeping them alive for as long as we can, they help us to do the other two well, which is don't water the suffering, and if suffering arises, take care of it right away. Be there for it to help it go back down to our store consciousness. Yeah, so we need to strengthen the positive in us, the capacity to trust ourselves, to have confidence in ourselves, in our own goodness, our own insight, our own wisdom, so that when we do see these other parts of ourselves which are really there, then we can maintain the balance. We don't think, oh, I'm just this negative seed that's now manifesting. We know that we're also other things too. We can never overdo watering the good in us. There's really no limit. We often tend to focus on what's not going well, and so making this habit of seeing the good is really important. And one way we can avoid watering the seeds of suffering in us is to be aware of what we consume, of what we take in through our senses, through our mouth also, but through our ears, through our eyes. And sometimes we want to consume things to avoid our suffering, to run away from it. And this actually just increases it. It might make us feel better for a while, but it actually makes whatever we're trying to avoid bigger and stronger. So we can practice to just inquire before we turn on the television or pick up something to read or phone someone or eat something or listen to something. We can just ask, why do we want to do that? And what, and just check in, what's motivating us? Is it wholesome? Is it something that really will nourish the good seeds in us? Or is it some effort to run from something uncomfortable inside? We were traveling with Thay up the coast of California in 2001 when we heard about the terrorist attacks, and on September 11th, and a bunch of us, you know, American monastics. Thay was scheduled to give a talk in Berkeley a few days later, and we were quite, of course, everyone was very disturbed, and we were wanting to do something and to, you know, kind of a little bit of frenzy of like, how can we address this? And how can we, wanted to just get more information, and spend a lot of time hearing and looking and trying to understand. And the next day, Thay said, we're all going to the beach. Because we were staying at a place near the beach, and so we spent the day at the beach, and swimming and being together, and I saw dolphins, a pod of dolphins swim by, and I somehow felt very comforted by seeing them, that they came close to shore, and it felt like some kind of reassurance. They were with us. But he didn't want us to just keep consuming things that would make us more and more upset, and maybe less and less grounded and mindful. And being outside, being, you know, with the water, was very healing. It was a very good, it was something I never would have considered in a moment like that, I would have thought, you know, 100%, let's respond, you know. But that would have, wouldn't have given space for, you know, positive seeds to be nourished, for, you know, a deeper grief to be acknowledged in just this, let's do, let's do, let's do. So this aspect of right diligence, of right effort, is very much about appropriate attention. And where do we direct our attention? And so the last aspect of right diligence is like the second one, it's the opposite. So if seeds of suffering have arisen, don't keep feeding them. Don't maintain them for a long time in your mind. Help them go back down. You know, help them be soothed. And I wanted to say a little bit more about the third, of just avoiding the seeds of suffering being watered through living more simply. So I read about a family who, this was a book on simple living. This was a family who lived off the grid and had an outhouse. And it's a single mom and her kids. And she shared that they spent a lot more time with each other because they didn't have a TV. The kids read a lot. They got books from the library. They played a lot in nature. They followed the rhythms of nature, going to bed when it was getting dark, waking up when it was getting light. And it was a very, very joyful connected life, where they felt connected to their surroundings and connected to each other. And slower, it was much slower, because they didn't have all the appliances. So as a nun, we practice not to have too much stuff, but I can tell you it's not easy to even in a container where we have a lot of support to live simply. I just find it's so easy to accumulate things, and how much energy that takes to decide what to keep, what not to keep, what to do with what you're not going to keep, how to use what you have, and realizing you just have stuff stored away that you never use. So I think this is kind of our reality in this time. That our stuff, our schedule, our projects, just the speed of our life kind of imprisons us, kind of keeps us from really being in touch with life. So learning to say no, to create quiet time, to do less, to really make the priority for our life what is most important. Are we going to be ready for death? You know, this is what we heard in the sutra this morning, and death comes unexpectedly. So living in a way that we can know that we're living the way we want to be living. So that if it's over tomorrow, we're not like, oh man, didn't do what I needed to do this life, you know. This is from Thomas Merton, a Trappist monk and peace activist. He writes, "The rush and pressure of human life are a form, perhaps the most common form, of its innate violence. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything is to succumb to violence. The frenzy of the activist neutralizes her or his work for peace. It destroys his own inner capacity for peace. It destroys the fruitfulness of her own work because it kills the root of inner wisdom which makes work fruitful." So I think also in this living simply, this how we relate to technology is a big area of potential suffering or violence, as Thomas Merton writes about. You know, just constantly being available, constantly, you know, getting messages and getting always, you know, being in communication or taking in, you know, the latest headlines from all kinds of devices and this is in Germany. I read that, you know, people spend 8 hours a day with some kind of device, you know, in front of some kind of screen or cell phone or whatever. But, you know, less than 2 hours a day talking to a person, you know. So in Germany, there's a group called the Network for a Mindful Economy. It's really not about economics, but more like how do we relate in the world with all the elements of technology and consumption. And a German Dharma teacher came up with a list of contemplations for busy people. I think I won't read them, but I'll maybe post them so everyone can look at them, because I think they're very, very skillful things. We can like read one a day, just take a few breaths and just see how that informs our life. Well, I'll just read you one or two. May I create brief periods of leisure even during busy days, phases in which there is nothing to do, in which my planning mind can come to a rest, free from having to follow the logic of achieving goals. Mm. That's one. One more. May I regularly enter into a mode of non-contact with work and projects, and may I grant myself the permission to be unavailable. And so I recently had the chance to be on a 3-month silent retreat with no internet or email or phone, or not even reading. We weren't even supposed to write very much, but I didn't do that practice so well. I didn't keep a journal, but I just took a lot of notes in the Dharma talks. And it was basically, you know, nothing to use to take us away from what was happening inside of us in that moment. And it was, you know, like no escape, really, you know, no side doors. It was really wonderful. At times it was really difficult, but it was really a gift to just like unplug from all those sources of input. It was really like fasting and purifying. Songs I listened to as a teenager were like coming up because I unplugged from all this other stuff, but then all the things I hadn't thought about or, you know, remembered, because I wasn't taking in, all this stuff could come up from deep inside. And it was really like coming up and letting it go. It really felt like a kind of purging. Felt much lighter. There was so much space for whatever had kind of gotten stuck inside to arise and be released. So that's this simplifying. Maybe you listen to one sound of the bell. So the last aspect of right diligence is when seeds of suffering arise, is to, you know, take care of them. Because if we are, say, angry for an hour, we're consuming anger for an hour. And our seed of anger in our store consciousness is getting an hour's worth of fertilizer for it to grow bigger. So the next time something happens that's maybe even just a little bit irritating, we get more angry quicker and it lasts longer. So that's training in anger or training in despair. You know, it's eating a kind of food. So when those emotions come up, we don't want to allow them to grow bigger in at their root. So it's not suppressing this practice. It doesn't mean we don't accept or acknowledge the reality of what is, but it's taking care of it skillfully, because there's suppression on one end and then there's can't think of the word, but making it bigger on the other side. And there's a middle way. So not suppressing, not feeding it, but skillfully taking care of it with our mindfulness, with our awareness and compassion. And there's different ways we can do this. sometimes we can change the peg, as the Buddha taught. We can substitute something else. And Thay says we're a television with many channels. So if we don't like what we're watching, if it's very violent, we change a channel. You know, we can put on a peaceful show. So I was once at a meeting and I was helping to organize something, and a sister and I were having an argument about what needed to happen in the meeting. And I was upset, she was upset. So Thay saw this in the meeting, and so when things had finished, he asked me to sing a song. And I knew that was his way of helping me change the peg to water other seeds in me than irritation, anger. So it's like, you know, it's like a child is playing with something, you know, dangerous, or it could be harmful. And we just give the child something maybe more interesting to play with. That's not, you know, that's safe. And they're very happy to play with that, actually. So it's the same in our consciousness. We can just offer ourselves something more nourishing to focus on. Like Thay also taking us to the beach, you know, after 9/11. When our pain is really strong, changing the channel, changing the peg, might not work, or might not be the most skillful thing. Just sorry to explain also the changing the peg. It came from in the time of the Buddha, pieces of wood were held together by a wooden peg, and sometimes it would rot, and it would need to be replaced. So you'd just take a new peg and you'd hammer it in to take the place of the rotten peg. So that's why he gave this example of changing the peg. But there are times when the most skillful way is to just really look at and be with whatever is arising, to call it by its name, and make space for it, and really accept that it's there, and see that it is a manifestation of suffering, that something has fed it so that it has come to be. We've either fed it, or our surroundings have fed it, or maybe it's from our ancestors' suffering. And so we give it space to be. We hold it with our awareness, with our care. So we don't reject it and say it shouldn't be there, that it's wrong. I don't want to be angry. I am not an angry person. But to say, okay, yes, this is also part of me. It's okay. You know? I can accept that this is coming up. Because if we don't accept it, there's no way for it to transform. So just like whatever we water grows, whatever we resist grows and gets stronger. There's a story of Ajahn Chah, a meditation master in Thailand. He was with his students and he pointed to a big boulder and he asked them, "Is that heavy?" And his student said, "Yes, it's very heavy. It's a huge boulder." And Ajahn Chah said, "It's only heavy if you pick it up. And that's the same with our suffering. If we resist it and fight it, then it's really heavy. But if we see it's our suffering, it's come to us to teach us something. If we make space for it, to learn from it, it doesn't need to crush us. Because there is a relationship between suffering and happiness. You know, all of these seeds belong in the garden. The seeds of suffering are not some misfortune that shouldn't be there. So we don't, we can't really know our happiness except against the background of suffering. And so in happiness is suffering, and in suffering is happiness. It's knowing and touching suffering that allows us to really know compassion. And it's knowing pain, that compels us to go on a spiritual path. So suffering and the end of suffering, those are the two things the Buddha taught. So that's all I teach, is suffering and the end of suffering. Well, you can't have the end of suffering without suffering. So this turning to our suffering with the eyes of interbeing, with the awareness that, you know, our enlightenment is made up of our suffering, that the lotus is made up of the mud, that you can't have a lotus without mud. We don't practice to become perfect. I thought when I was going to be a nun that I was going to turn into an angel. I really thought, you know, saint road for me. And I just thought all my suffering was not going to be there. Boy, was I wrong. So the first 2 months of being a novice, this is like, what? That's in me, and anger and judgment and aversion, and it came up really a lot. And I thought, what's wrong with this picture? And then 2 months into my novice time, I realized, no, this is exactly what's supposed to be happening. Because if I wouldn't see these parts of myself, how could I transform them? How could I claim all of who I am? Know all of who I am? You know, if I'm putting, you know, whole big parts of myself in a dark corner, trying to lock the door, that's not wholeness. It's not healing. So they were coming up so that I could practice mindfulness with them, you know, dance with them and learn from them and grow lotuses from them. So those are the four ways we can practice. We can make effort and be diligent.